And that's one of the things I'm always like talking to my students about. Like, it is irrelevant whether or not you like a play. It is irrelevant. The question is, like, dramaturgically, the question is, does it work?
Hey, everybody. Welcome to The Voracious Student and your podcast classroom. I'm Denis Lambert, your host. And each new episode, I talk to a new teacher about life and the arts. Today, we're talking all about dramaturgy, and I have a true expert in that field, Martine Key Green Rogers. Martine is a freelance dramaturg and director, and the past president of the Literary Managers and Dramaturgs of the Americas. She has worked at many, many theaters across the country, including the Goodman, the Kennedy Center, the Court Theater, the Pioneer Theater Company, and the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. She is currently the interim dean of the Division of Liberal Arts at the University of North Carolina School of the Arts, and she was previously an associate professor at SUNY New Paltz. She is also an author with two books in process. And Martine Key Green Rogers obtained her PhD from the Department of Theater and Drama at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. So I think I've definitely proved that she is an absolute expert in this. She was a joy to talk to. She's wickedly smart. If you're interested in new plays, near the end of the episode, she shares a long list of up-and-coming playwrights you might want to know. We talk about Shakespeare. We talk about August Wilson. We talk about her teaching. And I think that's all I have to say to set us up. Enjoy the episode with Martine Key Green Rogers, and I'll talk to you at the end. Martine, it's so nice to meet you.
Oh, it is lovely to meet you.
So we're going to talk all about dramaturgy today, which has been on my list since I started this show. It's something I feel like I should know more about than I do. I don't know if I should say that. Maybe I'll edit that out later. I definitely do know something about it, but let's pretend I don't.
Okay.
So, and let's pretend, or let's assume someone listening doesn't.
Okay.
So if you were to meet someone and they knew nothing about theater and they said, what do you do and what is dramaturgy? How would you go about explaining it to them?
That is such a good question. It is the question of the century, because I think it shifts and changes so much with the way that our industry goes. But I think the easiest way to describe what it is that I do is that I am a history and story consultant for playwrights and for productions and directors, et cetera. And my job is to question, how are we telling the story? Why are we telling the story? Are we telling the story in the best way so that our audiences now, here and now, understand what it is that we're trying to do and what we're trying to say by doing the thing here and now? So I think, you know, I think that's my really weird answer, and I'm sticking to it.
I love it. And I feel like I have to point out that you are our first PhD on the show.
Oh my goodness.
Was that always part of your plan? What made you want to get a PhD?
What made me decide to get a PhD? I think, honestly, one, a zest and a zeal for learning combined with the instinct to want to teach as well. Because essentially, I actually kind of talked myself into this train of thought without actually really, or this sort of path without even really thinking through what that actually meant. I think when I was in my master's degree program at Catholic, someone was like, all right, Martine, what is the goal? And I said kind of flippantly, but then it became actually my motto that I wanted to be a professor by day and a dramaturg by night. But then I realized that with a MA as opposed to MFA, that I was going to have to keep going or at least get a different master's degree if I was going to be a teacher or professor by day, you know, in a long-term, full-time kind of way. So I think that's why. But, you know, to be honest, I think I honestly was just interested in continuing to learn. And I think that's also why I went for a generalist degree program. My PhD is in a generalist field. It's a generalist PhD. I was just still curious. I think the theater theorist, theater historian in me was still sort of itching and scratching to know more. That's why.
You're clearly a voracious student too. Which
I am.
Clearly.
Appropriate.
Very appropriate. So back to dramaturgy.
When you're working with a playwright on a new play, what kind of things do you keep your eyes open for? What kind of questions do you ask them?
Well, I think maybe what I'll do is unpack my process a little bit because it kind of will answer your question. Whenever a playwright approaches me and says that they're interested in me working with them on a play, the first thing that I will do before I ever crack open their script is try to have a conversation with them about, like, what is the story that they're telling? Why are they telling it in the way that they're telling it? And really trying to get them to articulate what they feel like they want to do with their play and what they think they're doing with their play. And then I take a lot of notes. So, and then I go read the play, because the question for me is, did you do what you said in our conversation you were trying to do? And for me, if I read the play and what I am reading is not quite in alignment with what you said, then I know where we need to start. And I think also part of the process is, as one is writing, your idea about what it is that you're doing can change and can shift. So then the question becomes, is there a moment where we need to revise the way that you're thinking about your own play?
Yeah.
Because totally. I mean, you know, because just because you wanted to do something doesn't mean the thing that you did instead isn't valid. You just did something different. So I think really sort of thinking through that. And then, you know, a lot of the questions that I'm always asking is, you know, why, you know, back to what I sort of said earlier, why this play now? Like, what is it? What conversation are you trying to spark? And it can be literally as simple as, I wanted to write a silly show in order to spark some joy after a long pandemic. And then just making sure that those things are in alignment with what it is that you actually did. Because then, you know, if you say that you want to spark joy because we need something to laugh about after a long pandemic, but then I read your play and it's a Debbie Downer, whether you realize it or not, or let's just say it becomes maybe it's a satire of some sort. And so then the question becomes, were you looking for, like, what kind of laughter are you looking for? And that allows me to sort of poke at, because I think part of my job is to really, in the questioning, is to poke at what is the thing that you're wanting to say? What is that thing that you're most afraid of saying? Because sometimes that happens in a play where, like, you can feel where a playwright is holding back on something for some reason or another. And the question is why? And, you know, obviously, in a safe way, like, obviously, if they're holding on to something because there's a lot of trauma back behind it, like, you don't want to scratch at that wall. But if it's just because they haven't figured out how to say the thing it is they want to say, or they feel like something's not working, because I think that happens a lot too. Like, a lot of playwrights, you know, like anybody who's putting any art out into the universe, they're worried about its perception and its reception. And sometimes people won't go there just because they're worried about what's going to happen when it could actually be just fine. So I think the other thing that I try to impart with my playwrights is that, like, I'm in some ways a neutral, safe, and brave space to test ideas, to, like, go back and forth. Like, let's hash this idea out to the very end of it, because in the end, your secret is safe with me. If we get to the end of it and it's total hot trash, then we can pretend like we never had that conversation and move on.
I love it. No one ever know.
Exactly. I hold a lot of secrets in this brain of mine, a lot of dirty playwright secrets.
I have no doubt. You know, as I was listening, I was first going to ask you if why this play now is a more difficult question. But then I loved, you kept talking and it was more like, I loved you said something like, it doesn't have to be this huge answer, but it just has to be clear. Mm-hmm. Like, a joy at the end of the pandemic is enough.
Yeah. Because, I mean, I think that's the thing. Like, part of what we're doing in the theater, hopefully, is shedding light on all parts of the human experience. That includes, like, the mundane. It includes, like, the utterly silly. It includes, like, massive amounts of joy and sorrow and grief and happiness and love and pain and all these things. And sometimes I feel like playwrights are putting a lot of pressure on themselves to be, like, profound.
Change the world. Like, right. write the play of the century, right?
Right, exactly. Right. And sometimes maybe just writing the thing that's truly and genuinely on your heart is the thing that's going to change the world.
What makes you want to work on a play? And if I dare ask, what might make you not want to work on a play?
What makes me work on a play? I am back to what I was kind of, I am just genuinely a curious human being. genuinely, no doubt about it. I am the quintessential curiosity is always going to be the thing that kills this cat. And so as such, are they asking a question that I haven't thought, like haven't asked, or are they asking a question, a different question or in a different way that I haven't really thought of before? And, you know, cause I think of, for example, when I was working on Lauren Gunderson's premiere, world premiere of The Catastrophist with Marin and Roundhouse, one of the questions that she was kind of asking is like, who takes care of the people who take care of all of us? Like, who's that who takes care of that person? And that's such a really great question. And so I was like, oh, I totally want to go down this road. I think the thing that makes me not want to work on, there are two very distinct things that make me not want to work on a play. Either A, they're doing something that's already been done. And I mean that in a very sort of literal way. There was a play that I encountered one time that, I mean, I read the thing and like the whole time I kept thinking of like how it was like this combo of like this and this play and this play and this play and this play in one, but then not even in a really exciting way. And so I felt very unfulfilled by the time I got to the end of it. And to be honest, I still ended up working on it because I was like, okay, obviously there's something in all of these plays and playwrights that they're emulating that is important to them. And so like, let's do that. Let's go down that road and see if you can develop your own voice in that. But I would say, so maybe that's like a half of why I wouldn't work on something, but I ended up working on it anyway. But I think what makes me not really want to work on a play is that if there's something going, if a playwright is asking a question, but they're not genuinely actually interested in doing the work that is required to get to the answer. Huh. And usually where I find that, just to be completely honest, is in issues of representation around race, gender, and disability is usually where those plays that, you know, in the end are the ones that end up becoming highly problematic and are the ones that end up on like the front pages of like art sections because there is a like big old shenanigans and tomfoolery thing that came in its aftermath. Like, you know, not going to name any names, but there was a play that a larger regional theater company asked me to be a part of. And I was like, let me take a look at it. I took a look at it and I was like, oh no, I want nothing to do with this. Like everything about this to me illustrated that this person had no idea, A, the people that they were trying to write about, and B, the community that they were trying to write about. And really, honestly, it was just so careless in the way that it was treating these characters that I was like, I don't even want to talk to this person because like I want nothing to do with this. And then for a bit of irony, like maybe 4 or 5 months later, this play ended up being in like, you know, the sort of major newspaper for that area because that thing, it ended up exploding because the person was, this particular playwright was not a very good human being to people who did not look like them. And like the whole rehearsal process fell apart. And then they ended up having to cancel the show. And I was like, well, if y'all had listened to me when I said something with this play before, maybe you not have to go through that. But I guess that's where y'all are now. Woo.
And this is usually people writing about experiences that aren't their own, right? Yeah. Communities that are not theirs, right?
And one of the things that I'm always really careful to say to playwrights is that you can write about experiences that are not your own. The question is, are you going to do the work to make sure that you're being respectful of the communities that you're writing about if they're not your community? And if the answer is you're not willing to do that work, please save everyone, the mental and physical exhaustion of having to deal with your play. Just don't do it. Write about the things that you know about, because that's fine. There's nothing wrong with writing about what you know. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the other thing. And then also, like, I've found that people can be really sort of like disgustingly flippant about things like that. Like, I remember one time I was talking to a playwright who was like wanting me to work with them because they were like, well, I heard that, you know, the only way to get produced now is if you have like Black people in your play. And I was like, if that is the only reason why you're putting Black characters in your play, the answer is no. Period. The answer is no. on whatever question it is that you're about to ask, all of the answers are no.
Yeah.
Do I want to work with you? No. Do you think anyone's going to be interested in your play? No. Like, everything's no.
So let's talk. I want to talk about two specific playwrights and your work on them. You've definitely worked on some Shakespeare productions where they change, you know, the time or the location. Mm-hmm. What is your specific role in that scenario?
That's such a good question.
And do you enjoy it? Is that a challenge you like?
I adore every second of it. But I have to admit that I also enjoy it either more or less depending on when I am brought into the project to like discuss this. Because I find that the later that I'm brought in, the harder it is to reconcile all the things. Sometimes, like if they've gotten themselves into a dramaturgical conundrum, unpacking it can be a lot harder if I'm being brought in at the very end or later than everyone else than when I am at the beginning. So like one of my weirdest favorite ones that I did is like the late Mark Rucker did a really interesting and super sexy version of A Midsummer Night's Dream, in which the four different sort of categories of characters were set in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s.
Oh, wow. That sounds very complicated.
It is very complicated. And I'm not even 100% sure we pulled it off like perfectly. But what was really interesting and the challenge that, you know, like, as we were sort of unpacking this entire concept, like what happens when you have, for example, a prop that is shared by both like a group from the 40s and the 50s? What happens when it's a prop that is shared between someone from the 40s and, or the 50s and the 70s? Like what happens? And those sort of dramaturgical conundrums are really fascinating to me. And I also like enjoy the idea of unpacking what happens to a story. Because back to, if my whole point is, are we telling the story we want to tell? Then the question is, why are we telling this story? What is an audience supposed to learn from A Midsummer Night's Dream if our four characters are set in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s. You know, is it because of, you know, a need to talk about, like, is there a generational thing that you think is happening between these sets of characters? And the best way to sort of parse that out for an artist is to actually just physically do that, you know, like physically put them in different decades so that people really clearly understand that when, like, you know, the mechanicals who are set in the 70s are talking to the lovers who are from the 50s, like, that generational difference, you know, and using that that sort of decade difference to also illustrate issues of class and gender roles, et cetera. Is that the way we want to go at it? You know, and then how far in the weeds do we need to get into it in order to tell that story? Like, are we going to have to make some shifts and some changes to some of the words? You know, those are the things that is part of my contribution. And then also part of my contribution is either helping make the cut of the script or looking over a cut of the script. I'm working on a production of The Tempest right now with Hudson Valley Shakes. And Ryan was really interested in doing the cut, doing the pass on the cut. Ryan Quinn is the director. And so I was like, great, I'm happy to just look at it. And now we're kind of wrestling with gender pronouns in the show, considering the casting that he decided to go with some of the characters, and think, you know, asking the question, what is most useful, relevant storytelling strength? You know, do we leave these pronouns alone? What do we do? Right. And it's interesting because I think in The Tempest, very much so, there's a lot of gender dynamics at play here that actually kind of make a difference. Mm-hmm. In terms of thinking. So like what happens when, like, we all know that this person is talking about someone who presents as masculine, but, you know, or presents as feminine, but they say he, like, is it now a slight? Is it, what is it saying now? Mm-hmm. So these are the things that I end up doing. And there's like a million other things that I end up doing. Like, it's just kind of ridiculous. Like, Shakespeare's, doing any classic play is probably the most sort of time intensive and labor intensive show you can kind of work on. because there's just so much you have to do in terms of unpacking the language, what we're doing to it, if we're putting it in another place and time, reconciling those two languages, like visual vocabularies as well as aural vocabularies.
I'm curious about your thoughts about cutting Shakespeare. Do you like a trim evening of Shakespeare? Or are you, you know, sort of precious in keeping as much of it in as you can? Or does it depend on the scenario? You know, that's something I'm really fascinated by. And I enjoy both routes for different reasons.
Same. I think for me, it gets just back and dramaturgically, professionally. Because I mean, I think one of the things that's always really important to establish is that something that I might like aesthetically might not actually be the solid dramaturgical choice. And that's one of the things I'm always like talking to my students about. Like, it is irrelevant whether or not you like a play. It is irrelevant. The question is, like, dramaturgically, the question is, does it work? And that has nothing to do with whether you like it or not. Now, you might like a play because it works, or you might dislike a play because it doesn't work. But the question is, as a dramaturg, like, how can you articulate what it is that's happening that's not quite working, which is contributing to your not liking it? And there are plenty of plays that are dramaturgically sound that I don't like.
And I'm going to say too, like, you can like things that don't work, that you can see all the holes and flaws, and for whatever reason, it just, you know,
exactly,
tickles you.
Right. And I think that's really the important thing to learn about being able to talk about art, which is part of the reason why I keep telling my students that dramaturgy skills are life skills. Like, it is very easy for me if, like, someone comes up to me and they, like, let's say I see a production that I absolutely couldn't stand. I still can talk about it intelligently with someone besides just saying, I didn't like it. I can point exactly to the things that were happening in it that didn't work for me. And I can even separate as to whether or not it is actually something that aesthetically is just not my bag, but it's fine and it's fun and it works, versus the things that I'm like, I really like this. It totally doesn't work, but you know what? I liked it.
Right.
You know, and I think that's actually, you know, maybe potentially a sign of a maturity in the craft. And you can just be like, yeah, that thing didn't work, but it was great. It was fun. Or, oh, that thing was a hot mess. And yeah, that whole thing needs to go in the trash can to stay there. Or that thing was brilliant and people should do it always and forever and always.
It's pretty far back, but I definitely remember making the shift at some point. And I can't remember even really who prompted me to do it. But that, you know, to just say you don't like something or, God, that was awful, is just not something you can do. Like, right. That's just not, you're just not allowed. You're allowed to not like it, but you have to know why.
Right. You know? And, or at least, like, if you're going to be finding yourself in situations where you're talking about plays with people, like, you have to figure out how to actually sort of get at the crux of what it is that wasn't working for you. Because that's the other thing. Like, if someone's asking you your opinion about it and they either had something to do with it or they went to go see it too, it's because they want to engage. And the worst thing you can do is be like, nope, I'm not talking about it with you.
Right. Right.
I know you want my opinion, but the answer is nope.
Right. So the other playwright I'd love to talk about specifically is August Wilson. You worked on them, was it the whole Century Cycle at the
Court? Almost. I still have a few that I need to check off, but yeah.
So I kind of just wanted to open up a discussion about working on those plays.
Well, I mean, I think the thing that's most important about August Wilson's Century Cycle is that it was very specific in documenting, like, the experience, the Black experience, granted from a very specific lens. We're talking, and what I mean by very specific, we're talking Hill District in each decade, minus obviously Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, which is set in Chicago, but, like, really specifically looking at, you know, and also pretty heavily a Black male experience. Because, I mean, a lot of, even just, like, the sort of main characters, even though it's Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, this is really, like, Levy's play.
Right. Right.
You know, so very specifically looking at, like, Pittsburgh in the Hill District in each decade through the lens of, like, the community and specifically the Black male community. And I think that was just so, unfortunately, revolutionary at the time, but also so needed. At the time when he was writing, you know, it really gave us a peek into Black male life in a way that we had not seen on the American stage in a sort of mainstream large way. Because, I mean, obviously there were other playwrights that came before there. You know, you've got your Ed Bullens, Langston Hughes, et cetera. But, like, he was, like, the sort of first, like, superstar in terms of Black male playwright. And I think the thing that I love the most, honestly, about working on his play as a dramaturg is that, A, I'm, you know, a Black woman. And the first thing that I always do whenever I get to, like, crack into these plays again and again is, like, I get to hear, like, my ancestors. Like, I hear my family in the way that a lot of the men talk to one another and the way that they interact with women. Like, I hear my grandfather, I hear my, you know, great uncles, like, I hear them in my head. And that's just, like, such a great experience. Like, that moment, you know, when you truly see yourself and your life represented on stage, like, there's something just so magical about that. And then also, I think the community that is always built, like, it is super hard. And I mean this, like, in a real way. It is so hard to work on a Wilson and not have created a sense of community by the end of that process. Like, there's just no way. Because I think part of what it is that Wilson's work does is that somehow, like, I don't know how, but there's just something so communal about it that creates, like, everyone is just like, you know, we're like a family. By the time every single show that I've worked on, we're like a family by the time we're done working on it. And that's even more interesting to me sometimes as a dramaturg, because one, I bounce around a lot in terms of working on things, and I'm going to own all the privilege that comes with the fact that I'm working on enough things that I'm bouncing around from show to show and sometimes leaving a show and coming back and all that stuff. And, you know, whenever I work on a Wilson, even if I leave for a week or two and come back, it feels like I never left. And I think it's just hard to find that kind of real sense of community. And I, like I said, I've worked on a lot of Wilsons, and I've never not felt like part of a family and in a community, a part of a community by the time I'm done working on that piece.
You mentioned your students. Tell me a little bit about your teaching, your history with teaching, and what your current teaching position or positions are.
So I just left my position as an associate professor at the State University of New York at New Paltz. I'm actually on a one-year leave of absence from there in order to be the interim dean of the Division of Liberal Arts at the University of North Carolina School of the Arts. So that is where I'm sitting now in my office having this conversation. And it's interesting because I love teaching. I love education. And it's so weird, those things, those like nature versus nurture things. And part of the reason why I say this is because my family is full of educators, even though no one in my immediate family is an educator. My mom's not an educator. My grandmother wasn't an educator. Father, stepfather, is not like granddad. No one is an educator, but like in our extended family, there are so many educators, and I find that so fascinating on a really weird level. How like the desire to share knowledge can be like part of one's DNA, and I think that's the thing that's actually the most interesting to me about teaching. I find that like I don't really subscribe to the sage on the stage rule in terms of like how I conduct my classrooms. Like I feel like we're on a journey and an exploration together, and that I am still learning as we all learn, because especially considering some of the stuff that I teach tends to be right on the sort of cutting edge of things. Case in point, like at SUNY New Paltz, I was teaching an Asian drama class, but it was very sort of contemporary. And so like I'm talking to my students about like the newest shadow puppet theater in Taiwan. I'm talking about, you know, the new musicals that are being made in the theater district in Seoul, in Korea. Like that's what I'm talking about with them. And so as such, like it continues to shift. And I'm, you know, sometimes like researching like what a, you know, particular company's been up to, right, like until like 10 minutes before I walk into my classroom, and constantly like digging and looking for videos and all sorts of fun stuff. And same thing with like, you know, I taught a race, gender, and performance class. And so a lot of, you know, what I was doing was that syllabus, I would say probably anywhere from like a third to a half of it was always new from semester to semester, because I usually teach that every semester. And I would just dump a bunch of plays, not in a bad way, but I would just dump a bunch of plays and like say, okay, now we're going to talk about race, gender, and performance from this perspective, and whole new set of plays that, you know, I've either begged some of my playwright friends to let me get my hands on an early copy of it that, since it hasn't been published yet, in order to share it with my students and talk about it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, to be honest, I think what's really, besides obviously the information sharing part of it, that's exciting to me, I am just so interested in what the next generation of theater practitioners are thinking about. And I think just like, that's part of my due diligence as a human, part of my due diligence as a theater maker, part of my due diligence as an instructor, and also just a dramaturg generally. Like, I need to know, like, where are we going? And the only way I feel like I'm really going to be able to get a pulse on that is just to talk to people who are going to be doing it in the next few years. But I truly enjoy teaching. It is a genuine joy, which is why it's kind of weird to me, like in this position that I'm in right now, I'm not teaching this semester. I'll teach next semester. And I appreciate them obviously giving me a semester to just kind of get my feet underneath me and before I have to get thrown into a classroom as well. But there's just something weird about the fact that I know that the school year is looming and I won't be in like having my own class. Although I already have some friends here who are already teaching here who are like, you got to come do a guest lecture. So I get to still like, and I'm looking forward to being back in person with students. So I can jump around the classroom like I'm used to, like I'm a total weirdo in my classroom. Like when people get on this really amazing train, like that's like, I think the thing that my students are always laughing at and making fun of me about in a really great way is that like, if someone gets on this train, that's really exciting in terms of the, where their thought is going, like I will literally start jumping up and down in classrooms and like doing half splits and like just like random stuff because I get so excited about the ideas. Ideas are just like, they're my drug of choice. Ideas are my drug of choice.
Well, and that has to be so infectious. You know, I feel like the way a teacher says something is as important as what they say often. Because you, right. You can sense, you know, that enthusiasm or lack of.
Right.
What is
that tends to end up in my student email, that she's very enthusiastic about it. Whatever it is we're talking
You need
about.
A coffee before Martine's class.
Right. Exactly. What were you about to ask me before I like continued on that train?
What's the most challenging thing about teaching for you?
This is so mundane, but grading.
Interesting.
I hate grading with a passion. And part of the reason why, like, so here's the thing. Part of me loves grading because I get to see the ideas that are being manifested in class and whatever it is that like they're writing about or whatever it is they're doing. So yay. But also the thing that really gives me fire is the conversations, and reading someone's paper is not a conversation, or at least it's a very one-sided conversation, which I'm just absorbing all the things. But what if I have a question? What if I want to talk to you about this thing? Or what if you said this thing and I don't even really know what that means, but I feel like you're on the precipice of a really like profound idea. Like, and then also I'm just going to own that, like at this particular juncture in my life, I think especially because of the Rona, I spend so much time in front of a computer, and I do, most of my students submit their work online through our classroom management system. And so I'm like, oh, just the idea of sitting in front of my computer, like now after hours of being in front of my computer, now to sit in front of it to grade is just like, oh, someone stabbed me in the eyeball.
That's totally fair.
Because I have to admit that my grading was, I'm going to own that, like if I ever had a major fault as an instructor, is that I was always cutting it a little close in terms of getting stuff back to people in any kind of like expedient manner. And the Rona, it all just fell apart. I was like, you know what? I can't.
I think we all got a pass this year.
I hope so. Otherwise, I'm in trouble.
Could you tell me about a teacher in your own life that made an impact on you?
Oh my goodness, that I have to give the most ultimate credit where credit is due. My undergraduate advisor, Dr. Sally Shedd at Virginia Wesleyan College, but it's now Virginia Wesleyan University. She was the person who introduced me to dramaturgy. I am the monster I've become because of her.
And do you remember, like, how did she introduce it to you? Was it just
yeah. It was, you know, one of those really amazing kind of like life altering conversations that when you go into your professor's office, you're not expecting to have. But essentially, she had just started there because there was a different person who was the head of the theater program when I started. She came in my sophomore year and at the beginning of my junior year. So I think after like sort of a year of like dealing with me and kind of seeing where I went, she was like, so have you ever heard of this profession called dramaturgy? And I was like, no, tell me more. And then she started to explain what a dramaturg does. And I was like, that is the thing I want. I think technically the way she actually phrased it was like, you know, Martine, you're an amazing actor and everything, but have you heard of this particular field?
And so it was an immediate light bulb, like, yeah. Oh, this is for me.
Yeah, totally. And I mean that in like such a really weird and almost like kind of like weird, visceral way in which I was just like, I don't want to do anything else. I want to do that. And so like we had a performance or audition requirement in our department. Like you had to audition for everything, even if you didn't want to be in the show. Like you could turn down a role, but you had to audition to keep your like audition chops up. And so like I would go through the motions of auditioning, but then as soon as I was done, I would be like, but yeah, I don't actually want to be in this play. Can I just dramaturg this? And since there was no one else who wanted to be a dramaturg on anything at the time, like I got to dramaturg all the things. And so it was like a baptism by fire. And it was so good. And I just dramaturged all the things. And I ended up like maybe being in like a show or two after that. But I really was just like, I want to learn how to do this thing. And I want to keep doing this thing. And, you know, Sally was really great about indulging my desire to keep doing the thing. And therefore, and now behold the monster I've become.
The monster, the glorious monster. You know, if a really young person with no credits wanted to become a dramaturg, what advice would you give them?
That's a good question. They have no training and just want it, and they've heard about it and want to just get into it. I think the best way to learn about dramaturgy is by doing it. So I would say go find your local, like neighborhood friendly dramaturg and just be like, can I help you in some way, shape, or form? I think one of the things that's so interesting to me about sort of the theory of dramaturgy and the practice of dramaturgy is that I think there's a way that you can read sort of the theories behind dramaturgy and not quite get what that looks like in practice until you have to do it. Mm-hmm. And so you can read all the books about dramaturgy and still not really know how to dramaturg anything. Because there's so much more to it than just like going and finding a bunch of research. Like it's really about like, there's a curation to that like process of gathering materials. And then on top of that, you know, how do you curate all this information so it's useful to designers, to the actors, to anyone who might come across it, like blah, 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 blah. And so, I would just say find your local neighborhood friendly dramaturg and ask if they want some help. And hopefully if they're a good soul and a good human being, they'll compensate you for like anything that you do while you're helping them. And just get into it and do it.
Do you think most people get into dramaturgy from another angle of the theater?
Oh, totally.
That's the common.
I don't know if it's common per se. I think it used to be more common than it is now. I think there are people who just like genuinely are like come in and are, I want to be a dramaturg. But you know, I know a lot of playwrights who are dramaturgs. One, just because obviously they understand what it's like to have to write a play and sort of guiding someone else through that process. I think there are a lot of directors that are really great dramaturgs because they're thinking visually about this world and how all these things are coming together. And one of the things that's like, I'm going to own is always like my slight weakness in terms of really dramaturgically looking at a play is that I am always looking at story arcs, not necessarily character arcs. And you can have a very fulfilling story arc without having a fulfilling like character arc track. Sometimes directors are really great people to talk to in terms of whether or not like this, this particular character is like what they, how they function in the play might be solid, but like in terms of trying to help an actor get themselves into that world could be problematic. And yeah, I mean, I think there are all sorts of ways. I think the real major passion that you have to have is you want to talk about plays. You want to be able to look at a play and want to turn it inside out. Like, you know, one of my favorite articles to think about is the Eleanor Fuchs Visit to a Small Planet article. I don't know if you've ever read it, but it's such a really great piece, mostly because it's all about what are the questions we need to ask of this world? So not even the questions that we're asking the playwright. What are the questions we're asking of this world? How does time move in this play? There's like a whole section on like, just like the temperature. Is it hot? Is it cold? Is it dry? Is it, you know, like all of the things that you really actually need to wrap your brain around in order to understand this world, because you need to understand the world in order to then understand how are these characters interacting with this world. And like, so sort of just some of the basic, amazing baseline questions. It's just such a great article. And if you read the questions that like, cause I mean, basically a lot of that entire article is just questions to ask of the world. And if you read that, and there's like a fire and a spark in you about like, yeah, I should really be thinking about plays like this. You have the dramaturgical bug. You have the spirit of a dramaturg. Drop all the things you're doing now and just become, join the fold.
Are there any up and coming, perhaps relatively unknown playwrights you would like to give a shout out to and maybe recommend our listeners to check out and read?
Do I? Okay. This list might get a little long. You have to just cut me off.
Take all the time in the world. Everybody get out your pencils and pens.
Right, exactly. So like all of the playwrights that I work with at the Playwright Center are just amazing. So I am, part of my job is I'm also the fellowship associate at the Playwright Center. And so I work with all of the Many Voices and Jerome Fellows at the Playwright Center. And so like all of the cohort that just left and everyone that's coming in, they're just amazing writers, right? Really interesting stuff. So like I'm talking about Tylee Schneider, Candrice Jones, Shannon Teal Kearns, Katie Kavang, Christina Castro, Jacoby Johnson. Oh my gosh, his work, so good. It's so good. It's so sweet and heartfelt and like, it's just like the stuff that like chocolate covered, like nougat centered, like marshmallow goodness treats are made of. And then Nora Montañez, like her work is great because she's really playing with like the sort of fusion of sound and the sort of aural landscape of a play while also thinking about the dialogue within and really sort of playing with people's expectations of what they are hearing in terms of sound versus what people are saying, which is really great. And then like Lucas Bache is so great. Like his play 401 Not Found just like does things to my soul. And like Zola D and Atlee Robinson. I mean, there's just so, Lester Mayers. Like, I mean, there's just so many amazing playwrights. So just go, I would say like, you know, just go to the Playwright Center website and just like, have a field day, like reading all the plays and like, you know, finding out about the fellows that are there. I also, some of my favorites are Frankie Gonzalez, although I would say Frankie at this point is probably a little bit further beyond just like up and coming, but like him and Matthew Capitacasa. I mean, there's just so many good ones, like Rachel Karnes, Anya Pearson. See, this is a problem when you ask a dramaturg who works in new play dramaturgy who their favorite playwrights are, because I'll just keep going. maybe I should just stop.
That's a pretty good start. And I can put the link to that website in the show so people can check it out. Is there anything else on your mind? Anything you want to praise or vent about or chat about before we wrap up?
Praise. One of the things that I enjoyed, like if there is any joy to be found in a global pandemic, like even though I guess that's an oxymoron to say global pandemic, because technically I think pandemic includes the word global, but anyway, is that there's just some really interesting people thinking about storytelling in really amazing ways that kind of had gotten the short shrift because of all of the emphasis on like doing theater in theaters. And so people who are kind of on the cutting edge of doing work that is, you know, theater, but not necessarily traditional theater in the way that you think of. A lot of those people got to have their heyday when the pandemic rolled around, and I'm very happy. Like when, you know, like a good example of this is one of my favorite companies is a company called Who's Lewis. Small company, was created in Salt Lake by some students at the University of Utah. And now they're based in New York City, and they're doing a lot of installation work that includes like, you know, almost the sort of a theatrical version of Choose Your Own Adventure, but not like in a, but it's a combo of like, you know, film and theater, as opposed to like Sleep No More. Like I feel like Sleep No More also has a bit of a Choose Your Own Adventure feel to it, but it's like this hybrid of like, you can either go do it or you can interact with it through the internet. And like, that's kind of fun and exciting. Like the fact that like people are sort of pushing those boundaries of like, how can we use a combination of liveness and recorded or filmed performance in order to tell stories. And that's my jam. I love doing some digiturgy, as I like to call it. And so, yeah, so I think that's what I'm going to lift up is just like all the people who kept telling stories in spite of, or because of, or despite the fact that there was a pandemic trying to like keep us all isolated. People were still reaching out and trying to connect and tell stories in any way that they could figure out how to do it. And I love that. The tenacity of our field makes me happy.
The most tenacious. and I'm proud of that.
Exactly.
Martine, thank you so much for spending this time with me. It was an honor to talk to you.
Thank you. I'm glad. I'm happy that you had me, and hopefully you didn't just hear that chime. And if you did, I'm glad I waited until the very end.
And that was my interview with Martine Key Green Rogers. I love talking to her. I couldn't agree more about don't just say you don't like something, figure out why you don't like it. A seemingly maybe small moment in that interview I really, really, really loved was how she was talking about how she kind of just said one day, I'd like to be a teacher by day and a dramaturg by night. And then that just slowly became a reality. It's amazing how powerful our words can be and how a simple idea can just grow into something huge. A career, a life's work. And I'm so glad I asked her about August Wilson. I've learned a lot about August Wilson this year. If you didn't hear my interview with Callie Hawley from the documentary Giving Voice, we talked all about August Wilson and that. And I thought what she said about his plays building community was really beautiful. And that Midsummer Night's Dream production with the four time periods, that makes my head spin. She was so much fun. I hope you enjoyed listening to her. I hope you learned something. Martine's info will be in the show notes if you would like to learn more about her. Thank you for listening to the show. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a very special episode unlike anything we've done before. I hope you'll tune in and leave us a rating and review if you're so inclined. We appreciate it so much. Take care of yourselves, and I'll talk to you soon.